Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we've got music, music, music. In our first segment, we'll visit with the CW's musical comedy, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and talk about its Golden Globe-winning star and producer. And in our second segment, in the wake of big ratings and solid reviews for Fox's live production of Grease, we'll talk about all these TV live musicals and where exactly this trend might be going. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR's new politics podcast is where NPR's political reporters talk to you like they talk to each other. With weekly roundups, short takes on news, and reporting from the caucuses and the campaign trail, you don't have to keep up with politics to know what's happening this election year. You just have to keep up with them. Listen and subscribe to the NPR Politics Podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're humming to ourselves quite a lot this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair this week is our friend Kat Chow. Kat, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer for Code Switch, but right now I'm hanging out with the Invisibilia team.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. We like them.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get in podcast rumbles with them.
That's right.
We lose a lot. Podcast rumbles. So Glenn has been talking for months about how much he enjoys the CW show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of it too, but this week we decided to dive in a little. Co-created by Aline Brosh McKenna and the star of the show, Rachel Bloom, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend follows Rebecca Bunch, who, the theme song sort of explains it. So can we get that clip, Jess?
I was working hard at a New York job, making dough, but it made me blue. One day I was crying a lot, and so I decided to move to West Covina, California. Brand new pals and new career. It happens to be where Josh lives, but that's not why I'm here.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
What? No, I'm not.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
That's a sexist term.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
Can you guys stop singing for just a second?
She's so broken inside.
The situation's a lot more nuanced than that.
C-R-A-Z-Y.
Okay, we get it.
Crazy ex-girlfriend.
So as that song sums up, Rebecca was an unhappy lawyer in New York who moved to the town of West Covina, California, to try to be happy after learning that her long-ago summer camp boyfriend, Josh Chan, with whom she'd been long out of touch, was living there. So, Glenn, can you talk a little bit about what it is that you think you respond to in this show?
The songs. The show is great. I find that I keep going back and revisiting and keep going back and keep going back and mm-hmm. revisiting the songs, not necessarily rewatching the episodes, because it seems to me that the songs are just concentrated forms of what makes everything about this show so good. They're smart. They're very funny. The quality goes up and down. I have definitively ranked all 18 songs that have been played so far.
Nice.
In case we hit a lull. really good podcasting.
Help.
Yeah. But these songs, man, like, you should be warned if you're going to start this show that they are the musical equivalent of a seti eel. They're like a seti eel in a dance belt. They crawl inside your head and they wrap around your spinal column. And they are inescapable. So, for example, in my house for the past few weeks, if I happen to be in a part of the house and I'm looking for something and I ask where something is, or one of us mentions the room that houses the toilet, this is what happens.
Where's the bathroom? Where's the bathroom? I need to use the bathroom. Tell me that you have a bathroom in this hovel you call home. I don't know.
Oh, that is
from her horrible mother.
Her horrible mother. That is, of course, Tova Feltsche. I think she's Swiss. No, of course not.
And like Tova Feltsche.
Playing Rachel's mother in a very, very, not nuanced performance, but really sells it. A really great song that consolidates, that distills all of this motherly angst into one great showstopping number.
Yeah, and it's not all, it starts off with so much just picking at her about her skin and her weight and stuff like that. But then it goes into what happens in lots of visits with lots of people who you're uncomfortable with, which is that they also want to talk about a bunch of things you don't care about.
Yep.
Oh, did you hear? A bishop in Wisconsin said something anti-Semitic, so the temple has decided to boycott cheddar cheese.
And it's really, that song kind of goes on and is so great. And Tova Feltsche, I mean, seriously, if you are a Law and Order person, you have seen her many, many, many times as one of the most popular and widely used attorneys on that show. it was so lovely to me to see her in something so different and funny and light, right. And it's such a good use, I think, of her
talent. Yeah, she's a Broadway star. She has been for decades, and she's just in her element here. And that's it. There's not a dud in this cast. Right. Everybody is bringing something, bringing their A game. I love Daryl, who is a weird little character, plays her boss, but that actor, Pete Gardner, is just so... nailing it. There's a great song called I Love My Daughter.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
That he totally sells.
'Cause I love my daughter, but not in a creepy way. Though I realize father-daughter love comes off that way. I just love my daughter, but again, not in a creepy way.
Yeah, it's kind of the I Love My Daughter song is kind of one of these creepy.
It's really creepy.
Yeah, it makes you so uncomfortable.
If you think about the kind of glurgy father-daughter songs, the whole, was it Butterfly Kisses? Is that the one I'm thinking of? These kind of vaguely unsettling, fixated on the daughter song. And that's one of the things I like about the show is that so many of the songs are such specific pastiche pieces about some particular genre of music.
We should credit the songwriters. I mean, Rachel Bloom wrote a lot of the lyrics, but she collaborated with Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne.
I didn't even know that. He's written a bunch of like Broadway and movie
Broadway and movie and TV stuff. EGOT nominated.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel Bloom herself has such a good background, too. I mean, her videos of, what was it, the Disney Princesses? Mm-hmm. If you guys remember that, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And so I just love her comedy too.
You had not really watched this show, Kat, is that right?
No, I hadn't watched it. I kept hearing about it because people would tweet about me because of this Josh Chan character. Mm. And for the longest time, I put off watching it because I thought this was going to be like a selfie situation where, like the case of colorblind casting, where they just took, you know, an actor and who happened to be Asian and put him in there. But as I've been watching it, this is one of my favorite shows that I have seen on now. And Josh Chan, he's a Filipino-American, Vincent Rodriguez III. And his character is just so funny and kind of brutish on it, where he kind of seems sort of like a dud, you know, where you're watching him and you think he's kind of like this Asian bro, but there's so much more to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when she eventually goes and spends some time with his family, it's a very specific portrayal of this family that
totally
is pretty specific. Specifically, a Filipino-American family. And I think there are some really good interviews with Rachel Bloom where she's talked about this, where she kind of says, like, where I grew up in California, there were tons of, like, Asian bros that I never saw them on television.
I know, this is her reality.
I think she said the prom king at her high school was Asian. And she sort of said, like, I just never saw this represented on television. So to me, this was a very natural kind of thing to do. But I agree with you. At the beginning, he really seems like kind of a nothing, which is sort of part of the story. Mm-hmm. She goes all the way out there, and then you're like, that guy? Really? And you can kind of tell she's making it more than it is.
Sure, she's built him up.
But then he becomes, I feel like he redeems himself.
Toward
the later part.
One of the things that's really interesting about it, I think, is that I was debating with people during the airing of, by the time you hear this episode, it will have been the second to most recent one, what the end game of the show is and whether or not Josh Chan getting together with her is the end game of the show or not. And it's sort of remarkable to realize that you can actually debate that because people aren't sure. It's not clear whether it's her, whether it's him, or there's a friend of his whose name is Greg, who's played by Santino Fontana, who I also love. And I want to take a moment. Santino Fontana is also a song and dance man, as it turns out. I really love this one.
But I know there's another guy you fancy more. So, even though I'm not the one you adore, why not settle for me? Darling, just settle for me. I think you'll have to agree, we make quite a pair.
That little song, Settle For Me, turns into a sort of fantasy black and white Astaire and Rogers dance number. And it's really funny because it's such a dark sentiment. And yet it's being done in that very funny way. But I like the fact that Greg is a guy who kind of is infatuated with her initially, and then she acts like she acts. And he then legitimately doesn't like her.
Exactly.
It's not that he finds her enchantingly goofy. He really doesn't like her.
It's important that there's movement on this show and that the people make decisions, bad decisions, invariably bad decisions, and that those have consequences. So it's not the same show it was in the first episode. Right. We're not seeing the same dynamic repeated over again. It's getting deeper, and it's actually progressing in a way that I didn't expect it to.
I was surprised at how much I liked this show from the pilot. I did find that the first few episodes are very heavily tilted toward sort of cringe comedy in ways that if I'm not quite in the mood for cringe comedy, I'll watch it in 5 to 10 minute fits and starts and have to pause to collect myself. I have the actually the same reaction sometimes to The Bachelor.
Yeah, nice.
I noticed you guys brought clips from songs. I actually brought a snippet of dialogue. Can you believe it?
Oh,
I mean, they're
dialogue.
Only like, the songs are doled out fairly sparingly in this show. I mean, you mentioned there are 18 in, what, 9 episodes?
Yeah, only usually about a couple.
I found that the use of songs very similar to the use of songs in, like, Flight of the Conchords, where it's just weaving in a couple of them. They get bang for their buck with the songs. But I actually brought a clip of, it's from the first episode. It's Greg asking Rebecca out on a date. And it's just, it is this perfect moment where you just instantly love him.
Do you want to go?
Yeah, is there, like, a paperless post that I should reply to?
Why don't we just go together?
Great, yeah. Okay, so you'll come to me in a car?
Yes, like a date, because you're pretty and you're smart and you're ignoring me, so you're obviously my type.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Perfect.
And meanwhile, she's like looking around.
Yeah, she's waiting.
For Josh.
She's like, she's looking around for Josh. Yeah. But that the line read of perfect.
Yeah.
is so charming. And I like the fact that they, instead of, like you said, Glenn, having him kind of stay in that lane, they bring out darker and darker. They certainly bring out a lot of sweetness in him, but he's not just sweet. He's not just doting. Mm-hmm. I love that character.
Yeah. I think it's fair to mention that a lot of people have been uncomfortable with the title of this show and to some degree with the premise of this show. The producers, Rachel Bloom and also Aline Brash McKenna and some of the other people associated with the show, took some questions at press tour last summer about calling it Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and kind of said, we're glad you asked because for us, it's really about exploring the limitations of that as a stereotype. And I think they mean that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the show makes clear that it is happy to deal on all fours with the fact that Rebecca has issues of anxiety and depression and things like that. And she talks about that. But the summing up of her as Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is something that clearly the show is about how not the point that is.
Right.
And yet it has really turned people off, some people, not just because of the title, but I think the entire premise is a little cringy. And when I first was watching the show in the first couple episodes, my thought was, I really like her. I really love some of the other people who are on the show, Donna Lynn Champlin, who Glenn has talked about in the past, who plays Paula, her friend. I love all those people, and yet I wanted it to be less about Josh. I wanted it to be less about her actually sitting around and waiting for Josh. And I have mixed feelings about the fact that he has stayed so much part of the show, because as Kat said, he's turned out to be a much more interesting character,
right,
I think,
yeah,
and brings out different things in her than I originally expected. And yet, when I started watching it, I sort of thought, well, the way that this is going is it's not really about him. It's really about her looking for something different in her life. And I sort of expected him to be a little more of a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mixed feelings about the fact that that's not the case.
That he's still an actual love interest.
Yeah. And I still, you know, one of the things I talked about on our New Year's episode is dealing with those things where you stay in that tension of, I don't like everything about it. There are things about it that I'm not sure I don't wish were different.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I really, really love lots of things about it.
But
you know?
I do think there is a lot of self-awareness in the way that they're
absolutely
handling a lot of
stuff.
I mean,
yeah,
you heard the theme song. It's
absolutely,
you know, right there when they say Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She just comes out and says, that is a sexist term.
they don't even
keep that as subtext. I mean, there's in the first episode, there's a scene and it's played for laughs where she's dumping all her pills. You're sort of seeing this escalating series of very, very, very poor choices. I remember being so relieved getting to like episode 7 where they kind of come back to that.
Yeah,
yeah,
and
they do.
Get get some of the, you get into some of the consequences of that. I mean, because the first few episodes in particular, there's so many bad choices and so much following of bad advice that it is a little, it does make it a little tricky to relate to the show. You it's hard to fully attach to characters who are behaving in some cases so poorly. And I've liked the show more as it's drifted a little bit from each episode is the fallout from a terrible, terrible, terrible decision.
Yeah, right. I will say that I think one of the characters, she's more of a minor character who gets kind of introduced in the middle of the season, is the neighbor.
Yeah.
Who, she sort of has this persona where she reminds me of April from Parks and Rec, where she's kind of like droll and very blasé. And there's a scene where Rebecca is kind of knocking around on her neighbor's doors looking for someone to attend her party. And this neighbor looks at her and is like, sure, I'll come. You'd be like a good subject for my Psych 101 class or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so the subplot of that neighbor becomes like her looking at Rebecca as a social experiment. And I feel like that in a way really provides a check on all of the stuff that Rebecca does.
Yeah.
And I really liked that balance. And of course, that neighbor herself becomes a slightly more in-depth character.
Yeah.
Not much more, but she becomes a part of the story.
How do we feel about Josh's girlfriend?
I think I read somewhere a criticism of the show for the way it portrays that character as just venal and awful, but that you need a villain. You need somebody to hiss and boo. And when she did Good at Yoga, that was a really fun song.
Yeah.
The most recent song she did, not as strong. It's number 18 on my list, by the way.
But
they can't all be gems. I like the character. I think it's a good performance. And I'm not supposed to like the character. I'm supposed to... And
it's kind of a thankless role.
Right. And that Good at Yoga song brings up something else that I think it's fair to touch on, which is that in all of these, one of the things that's really, I think, brave about this show and sometimes imperfect about this show, they are very head on in like, we're going to do a hip hop pastiche.
Right.
We're going to do the yoga song is very much a take on like, I would describe it as what white musicians think Indian music sounds like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, as Stephen said, it's very self-aware. But again, you have those moments where you're like, I don't know about this. I'm not sure how I feel about the way they're doing this send up. And yet they often turn out to be really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How sustainable is this show?
Mm. I think that's a great question.
I had a little bit of the same reaction to this show, which I love, to another show I love, Jane the Virgin, where the title of the show makes it feel inherently unsustainable, right?
Yep.
Like, Jane the Virgin is, like, ultimately... is not going to be true to that title. There's so much growth over the course of these episodes just in relationships between these characters. She is occasionally actually helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Other people are occasionally actually helpful to her. The show isn't always going to be about that, right?
Before, as we tape this, the most recent episode, which was the first one they had after they got back from the break.
The beach episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
The beach episode really takes a step, I think, in the narrative to start to get away from the original setup, which has a whole bunch of, I think without spoiling too many specifics, there are a bunch of pieces of the premise that then she navigates for those first 8 episodes. One of which is the fact that obviously you don't tell the guy, I moved all the way out here to California because I wanted to see if I could hook up with you, my summer camp boyfriend.
From many years ago.
It tried to kind of, I think, advance both who Josh is and how she's functioning with people. I do think that the first 8 were kind of that premise playing out. Now she's kind of, Greg doesn't like her, so there's this tension with him. And so, you know, but she and Josh are kind of friendly, which introduces a whole different set of complications for her. So I think they did take a narrative step that is designed to start to combat some of that.
Yeah.
The first time you see a character besides Rebecca singing, it took me back because I thought that's what the show, I thought the premise of the show was we're inside her head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Paula who sings Face Your Fears, which is a
great song. Yep.
I think it's that moment when I see, oh, what's happening is she is changing the town as the town changes her. That's what I mean about growth. That's what I mean about this show actually not sticking to its very, very specific premise and allowing itself to kind of get a little messy.
Yeah. And I kind of like the fact that they chose as their kind of magical town this place that they're not really arguing has a lot of inherent magicness to it. It's not like... I went to New York and I love New York, or even I went to Hollywood, or I went to London, or whatever. I think they're trying to emphasize that the town is only special to her because of the people that are there and the experiences that she has, and the beach, of course.
I was going to say, 2 hours away, 4 hours of traffic.
The beach isn't bad. But, you know, it's not as if she has moved to a place where she can argue, now my life is totally different and magical because I moved to this particular geographic location. Anyway, I will be eager to hear from those of you who are watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, we're still in the world of musicals. We'll talk Grease Live and the sudden rebirth of the televised musical. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Stitch Fix, the online personal styling service that makes it possible for everyone to have their own personal stylist. Just fill out a style quiz to tell them your sizes, budget, and style preferences, and then schedule a date to receive your first personalized shipment. Your stylist will send you 5 hand-selected pieces of clothing with styling suggestions and outfit ideas for each piece. Choose what you want to keep and easily send back the rest with free shipping both ways. To get started, visit stitchfix.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is standing firm for musical comedies on television, but full-out productions of Broadway shows have also made their way back to TV, starting with The Sound of Music Live in 2013, followed the next 2 years by Peter Pan and The Wiz. NBC is staking out territory in this area and has earned some nice ratings. And this week, Fox got into the game with its live production of Grease. They're also going to be doing a production of Rocky Horror Picture Show, although that one isn't going to be live. And ABC is also working, I don't know if you guys know this, on a musical TV adaptation of Dirty Dancing that will star Abigail Breslin, also not live. Dirty Dancing. And apparently it's not just the, you know, at Kellerman's we come together. They're actually doing a musical, apparently, I guess. Only some of you get that reference that I just made, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. We made everyone watch Grease, whether they would have or not. I would have. I want to start with the tough sell that is Stephen Thompson watches Grease, and I want to know how it went for you.
It was really long.
Yeah.
I was really taken aback. Like, I tweeted this. I was a jerk and tweeted, like, if you love Grease, but wish it were longer than The Hateful Eight and had Mario Lopez in it.
Which I did. No.
Which, you know, is oversimplifying and mean. Obviously, there are commercials. They needed to get to their, they needed to hit their 3-hour mark. So they needed to find, they obviously also needed to do a certain amount of set changing and letting actors breathe and go to the bathroom. I found it to be just a fairly flatlined karaoke remake of the movie, right? Like, they didn't really add or change much. That said, it is an unbelievable feat of staging.
Yeah.
Mario Lopez, I heard him say American Bandstand instead of National Bandstand. Largely glitch-free, right? There was like a little sound problem here and there.
And they opened with
in LA.
They opened with one of these very, very long tracking shots through the set with Jesse J singing, singing Grease, the song, not from the show, but from the movie. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this one, I think there's no question, was produced and directed with massively more sophistication than the NBC ones have been.
Yeah, and so there were many scenes in which I watched kind of mouth agape at how did they do that? Like, as if you saw, you know, any number of incredibly lavish theater productions. It was beautifully made, but if you take it for actually what it is, if you're just watching it on TV, and I wasn't really playing along on Twitter, which I think is part of the joy of these things, for me, I just sort of felt like, why am I watching this?
But what'd you think, Kat?
I really liked it. So actually, I had just finished watching the original Grease, the movie, and then so I kind of was able to watch it back to back. And I went into watching the live version telling myself that I wasn't going to be nitpicky about the details and like what happened or what didn't happen. And I think the performances, I was really kind of impressed with all that. And the first bits, so for example, Vanessa Hudgens, she played Rizzo. She had just lost her father.
A day earlier.
I mean, for me personally, I feel like her performance took a while to warm up for her to become
a
believable Rizzo. But I think I felt that across the board where the beginning scenes, they just needed to find their rhythm.
I agree
with
that.
It felt really rushed. But then there were some numbers where they were amazing. Like when Vanessa Hudgens started singing, "There Are Worse Things I Could Do."
I don't steal it.
Oh,
I think Vanessa Hudgens, since we're on that point, had in some ways one of the hardest movie performances
to get people to forget. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because despite the fact that the show existed well before the movie and has existed in many iterations since the movie, and Rizzo has been played by everybody from Rosie O'Donnell to, I want to say, Brooke Shields played Rizzo at one point.
Makes sense.
I think it's Stockard Channing in the movie mm-hmm. at the age of 34, it should be said, mm-hmm. who people have in their minds when they want Rizzo to be that world-weary person.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, like you say, having lost her dad, like, I actually thought she acquitted herself quite well. What'd you
I
think, Glenn?
She was fine. No, it was great. I thought they nailed it, frankly. I mean, I just, from a pure technical achievement, moving from soundstage to soundstage, movement. I'm going to come back to that because this thing moved where Sound of Music, Peter Pan, and to a lesser extent, The Wiz, didn't.
Because, I agree with that.
Because there is no audience. You need, for musical theater, you need an audience. It is engineered to elicit a certain kind of response.
Right.
And when you don't have it, it's like airless. It's like,
right.
I read a review from the New York Times who said they prized spectacle over story. And it's like, well, A, it's a musical.
Right.
B, it's a musical. C, this story is not exactly Anna Karenina, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very simple story. And then the Washington Post said it was not libidinal enough. And I don't know what he was talking about because I saw some pretty good arms on that stage.
Uh-huh.
And my libido was taken care of.
Yeah.
But again, it's not like this is where you go for your hot, raw sexuality because this is a pastiche written in the 70s of 50s. It's all a confection.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did think was interesting in a mixed to negative review was from Robert Bianco in USA Today, who mentioned that Grease has kind of gone from being a musical that originally kind of poked fun at 50s nostalgia mm-hmm. as kind of goofy and regrettable, and that now it's become kind of toothless as it becomes kind of more sincere. And I do think one of the things that happened in the production on Sunday night is that particularly Danny Zuko, played by Aaron Tveit from many Broadway things. Were Trey here, he would name them all for us. That performance was much more kind of serious and earnest. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you are going off of John Travolta from the movie, which again, not the original Danny Zuko, but the Danny Zuko the largest number of people will have seen, Travolta is at his most goofy.
Yeah, so what are we going for?
I was
going
to say goobersome.
Goofy and goobery and really kind of chews on the exact thing that Bianco's talking about. The idea of that character being cool is so ridiculous. And the way that he was played Sunday night, he is cool. Mm-hmm. Like, you actually would look at him and like, oh, yeah, that's a hot, cool dude. Mm-hmm. Whereas when Travolta played him, there's that feeling of him constantly doing that laugh of like, huh, 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 huh. Mm-hmm. And it's sending up the idea that he's cool. So I think in that way, it was a little off for me. I think Julianne Hough, who played Sandy, is not an actress. No matter how much they try to make her an actress, she's a dancer. Mm-hmm. There were some supporting performances that I really liked. I thought Anna Gasteyer, who played the principal, was really funny and right on what that character is supposed to be. They brought in Bunk from The Wire, Wendell Pierce, to play the coach of the football team, which I thought was a stroke of genius. My personal favorite was Heather Donahue, who is on You're the Worst on FXX, as Jan, the sort of the brusha girl. And she, to me, was the one who knew the best what show she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the one, and that's how she is on You're the Worst, too. She has kind of this broad, sexy body thing going on that's a little cartoony. And I think that worked really well in this show. I liked Kiki Palmer, who played Marty.
Yeah.
I liked Hudgens. I liked a number of people.
You know, you mentioned Jan. Eve Plum.
I know, right?
Eve Plum as the teacher of the auto shop, or what do you call that?
Yep. Yeah, mechanics class,
Yeah, random. And they brought back Didi Kone.
Nice. Playing the, because Carly Rae Jepsen, if you haven't heard this, played Frenchie, who's the one who winds up going to beauty school. Didi Khan, who plays this scene where a kindly waitress gives her advice. And in this, Carly Rae Jepsen got the advice from the waitress, Didi Khan, which I thought was very sweet, and I was glad did that. I also really liked the fact that they did a curtain call.
Yeah.
I thought that was very cool at the end. Cool. They did a curtain call.
Well, they had to fill 3 hours.
I get it.
I like this fine. What does the sudden rise of live musicals on network television say about the state of network television? Are networks forced to manufacture live events in order to offset DVRing, in order to create social? I mean, all these things have been very, very social media focused. Lots and lots and lots. I mean, my Twitter feed was all Grease Live anytime I looked in on it. Is it just that's forcing network TV to experiment more?
Well, what still works on network television, right? Football.
Yep.
Sports. Mm-hmm. And I think they are, in a way, trying to find what do you give a different segment of the audience that brings some of the things to them that other people get from sports. That is my simplest explanation. But I also think you have to look back at, like, Glee and some of the stuff that came from Glee and American Idol. I think you have to look at the expansion of music in television over the last 10 to 15 years and say there have been a whole bunch of ways to try to incorporate music and performance and dance, Dancing with the Stars, think you can dance and other stuff. And I think the advent this year of Hamilton being kind of a Broadway show that has managed to become a bona fide, you don't have to be a theater person, pop culture phenomenon that's actually cool to non-theater people is related to what I am hoping is a genuine surge in interest in musical theater. I gotta tell you.
I agree with that. I think the live event nature of it is hugely important. I agree. I also think the massness, if that's a word, of the appeal of the object in question. You choose things, or at least you're supposed to choose things, that are going to hit and make television what it used to be, which was a mass communication device as opposed to a niche communication device. And so Sound of Music, no-brainer. The Wiz, arguably. The outlier there is Peter Pan. Don't kind of understand what it was doing in there.
No.
But Grease, Rocky Horror, I'm going to put in my vote for Little Shop. I think that's inevitable. Sure. I think that's going to happen.
I think that's inevitable, too. Mm-hmm. I think that's inevitable, too. And interestingly, they had first announced the Music Man for the spot that eventually went to The Wiz. Yeah. And I think part of what you can see there is network television at that same time figuring out, like, maybe not everything we make should be entirely white people. Yeah. Like, maybe there's something to be said for expanding our reach in a variety of things that we're doing. I mean, The Wiz is also a, you know, legit famous show and famous movie
but
and
it was
all
also,
that
like,
stuff.
That was a really good production, right? I mean, I was flipping back and forth because it was
far better than the previous two.
It was opposite sports.
Easily the best of the NBC ones, I think, for sure. And I think they're only going to get better at doing this because eventually what you're going to have is people who are experienced making live musicals for television, which used to be a thing. I actually brought a little clip. This did used to be a thing that they did in 1957. Julie Andrews was in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, which was written for television, which they wrote for television to be on CBS. And it was watched by, I believe I read, 100 million people.
Wow.
So I brought just a little tiny bit of Julie Andrews.
In my own little corner, in my own little chair, I can be whatever I want to be. On the wing of my fancy, I can fly anywhere, and the world will open its arms to me.
She really hits that own, doesn't she?
That is finally out on DVD. I think it took a long time to come out on DVD, but that is out on DVD. And it is really charming. I mean, the quality is not great, the video and audio quality, but it's really charming. And they remade that once, only like 8 years later with Leslie Ann Warren, but then they remade it in the 90s with Brandy and Whitney Houston. Mm-hmm. So there is some history of this. I don't know.
There's also, I mean, we talked about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend in the beginning of this show, and now obviously about these live musicals. You also have Gallivant.
You have Gallivant, which is great. Mm-hmm. Which is great. The first song of the second season was a whole thing about how they couldn't believe that they got a second season. And they probably won't get a third, but it's so charming. You see all these British actors you never really get a chance to see over here. They have this format down. It's half an hour with usually three songs. So
that's
it is packed.
Yeah, that's packed.
And they're doubling it up by doing two episodes a night. And it's just a perfect chunk. It's the perfect way to digest this stuff. And it's so clever.
They've always kind of wanted to do this. There was a time in the 90s and the early aughts when ABC had done, partly through Wonderful World of Disney, a series of little musicals. They did not just the Cinderella with Whitney Houston and Brandy, but also they did Annie, they did Bye Bye Birdie, and they did The Music Man with Matthew Broderick. So they have always kind of wanted to get this to work. And for me, it's kind of thrilling to have them say, maybe what you need to do is make it more like theater and give it more the feeling of theater. I thought one of the things that was very interesting about the Grease production is that they called in to direct. They called in Tommy Cale, who directs Hamilton, I believe, and a bunch of other very good stuff on Broadway. So, you know, they went to an interesting Broadway director to do a Broadway show, even though it's for television. Yeah. And I think one of the ones that really stood out for me was Greased Lightning, which not only did I think the dancing was much better and more interesting to watch than in most of the musicals that they've done so far. And Grease is more of a dance show, certainly, than The Sound of Music. but I think they were getting better at boldly using, like, you can change the camera angle. You can cut. If you get really good at putting your Steadicam where it's supposed to be and putting your different cameras where they're supposed to be, you choreograph that just like you do the dancers so that you're not just filming a group of people, which is not a particularly compelling way to watch dancing on television. Anyway, well, I thought it was a lot of fun, and I will be very interested to hear what y'all think about it. So Facebook us or tweet us. And when we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from HBO Now, the new way to stream all of HBO. Every episode of every season of HBO's series, plus the biggest and latest movies before any other streaming service. And no TV package is required. Download the HBO Now app on your favorite device to start your 30-day free trial instantly.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is that time. It is that time when we tell you what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
This is not going to be a huge surprise to those who know me, but Kung Fu Panda 3. It's so good.
Oh, Kung Fu Panda 3.
Can you be dispassionate enough to tell me if it's better than the second, better than the first? Well, like, just truthfully.
I think it's comparable to the second. The first one is by far the funniest. The first one is just packed with jokes. I have said for the longest time, if Kung Fu Panda were called The Dragon Warrior, it would have made a fifth as much money, and it would be an animation classic. Those movies are way better than they're given credit for because they're called Kung Fu Panda. Now, I will say,
I love this. I love that you say that despite the fact that the only reason anyone made this movie is that it was called Kung Fu Panda.
It's so good. So, okay, so what's it about? There's this panda.
Right.
No, the first one is very funny. The second one is going a little bit more into, like, how he was orphaned and is definitely a somewhat sadder Kung Fu Panda.
More serious backstory.
A little more serious backstory. And it is like this movie. First, they're both directed or co-directed by a woman named Jennifer Yu, who did just this beautiful work. Both 2 and 3 are visually spectacular to look at. There were scenes in this movie where I just kind of gaped at it and was just like moved by how pretty it was. And yet it is a movie about a silly panda.
Do you cry at Kung Fu Panda?
I do cry at everything though. I cry at all the things. I cried at this. It is one of those movies. Thank you, Linda. It is one of those movies where the closing, like an animated movie where the closing credits are like 12 minutes long because just entire cities of people were involved in making it look and sound as good as it does. But, you know, people are very excited about their Star Wars trilogy. For me, the Panda Trilogy. That's what it's all about. They're actually similar. In this one, like in Return of the Jedi, it has lots of cute little moppity characters around, I think handles it better.
Nice.
Anyway, Kung Fu Panda 3, I enjoyed it a great deal.
Thank you very, very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, can you possibly top...
Oh, I don't know.
Kung Fu Panda 3.
Two things. Gilmore Girls is coming back.
Yes, it is.
Because it's official. Everything comes back. Everything comes back now. So that fills me with 80% excitement, 20% dread.
Sure.
I think that's pretty safe fuel mixture there.
Anticipointment,
exactly, as you say. And they're getting a lot of the original cast. Yannick Truesdale, the amazingly named Yannick Truesdale, who played Michelle, tweeted a photo from the first, you know, cast read. That was very exciting. The Wikipedia tells me that Yannick Truesdale quit Hollywood and moved to Montreal to open a spinning gym, which, if you know the character of Michelle... He's a little on the nose, maybe. But, yeah, I'm very excited about that. It's coming back to Netflix. I think it'll be short, like maybe 6 episodes.
Yeah.
That's what they should do. Thanks, Netflix. The other thing is that Agent Carter is also back.
Oh, yes.
It's unfair to compare Agent Carter, which this season has 6 episodes, the first season had 8, to something like Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has 20 or 22.
Uh-huh.
But let's do it anyway. This show is so much better because it's a testament to the second draft, to going back in, and when you have a bit more time, saying the reason the show is so much better is simply the dialogue. It's a high-concept show, so there are going to be long clots of exposition, right? You have to explain things. But there is never a moment, never a passage of dialogue that happens on Agent Carter that is simply giving you information. Always we get characterization. Infused into the dialogue is how the character feels about the information they are imparting or not imparting. It's a testament to saying, go back, try again. Instead of just simply getting us, being the connective tissue, let's make this flesh. Let's make this real. Let's make this rounded and good. The performances are fantastic. The tone is perfect. I have no idea what's going on. because again, plot. Who cares about plot holes? It's a stupid thing to worry about. Don't worry about the plot. Worry about the characters. Make me feel what they feel. Make me understand them. And that show does it well. Agent Carter, it's worth your time.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Miss Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, lady?
What's making me happy is, speaking of things that should have comebacks, I've been kind of watching the show Wishbone again. Yeah,
no.
What's the story?
Wishbone.
Do you guys remember that?
Uh-huh.
So basically,
our producer Jessica Reedy is pumping her fist in the booth.
Oh my God, it's such a good show. So basically, in that show, there is a live and real Jack Russell Terrier, and the dog sort of. I mean, he doesn't talk in real life, but in the story life, he kind of brings the viewers...
They didn't get an actual talking dog.
No, it's like a... It's such a good show. So this dog kind of introduces the readers to a live-action retelling of a classic book, classic literary whatever. And so I decided to start rewatching them to kind of figure out how true to these books they are. Because, you know, I would say that growing up watching Wishbone, it became the thing that I could use so that I wouldn't actually have to read books. Like, I don't think I ever read The Tale of Two Cities, but I watched The Tale, the T-A-I-L of
there
Two
you go.
Cities.
See what they did there.
Yeah, see what they did there. In this first episode that I watched, you know, it was kind of a letdown, I have to say, because it was about the adventures of Tom Sawyer. Not as accurate as the real thing. And so I felt like, on one hand, I got to really sort of relive this childhood experience, but then I also, on the other hand, got to, you know, have my dreams and knowledge crushed.
Oh, sure.
This is a ritual that you'll repeat many times
as
you age, Kat.
I know, but...
You're just getting old enough to be disappointed in this particular way.
With Wishbone, too, man. Mm-hmm. But still a good show.
Is it Canadian? It feels Canadian.
No, it was shot in Allen, Texas.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So another Texas tie. I would advise, if you do watch the show, if you do decide to YouTube it or whatever, do not Google how old the dog is, because it will make you very sad.
Oh,
oh no.
But on that note, that's actually what's making me happy.
That was
the show,
awesome.
not the Googling.
That was absolutely awesome. I loved that so much. Thank you very much, Kat Chow. As you know, if you listened to this show a couple weeks ago, we had as our fourth chair my dear friend Sarah Bunting, who works over at Previously.tv and is on their Extra Hot Great podcast and there again with this podcast. This week, well, after we had Sarah on the show, I should say, people began asking on Twitter, like, why haven't you been on Extra Hot Great? Like, asking me, why haven't you guested on Extra Hot Great? Hey, Extra Hot Great, why don't you have Linda on the show? Which is an incredibly awkward thing for people to do, because they don't necessarily want to answer that question in front of me, and I don't necessarily want to guess. So when people are like, how come you haven't been on Extra Hot Great? You don't want to be like, I don't know. But anyway, the point being, by the time you are hearing this podcast, you will be able to hear me on Extra Hot Great, which I taped with them this past weekend. Now, as you know, if you listen to Extra Hot Great, they have a very special and important segment called The Canon, in which they all vote. This is the original Television Without Pity founders, Sarah Bunting, Tara Ariano, and Dave Cole, plus Joe Reed, who I worked with at Television Without Pity and who I lived with in Brooklyn for a year. They all vote on a submitted episode of television to see whether they will put it into the canon, which theoretically is this Hall of Fame of important television. But if you make a good enough case, you can sometimes get something in there that's not completely serious. So after considering a variety of options, I submitted to the canon during my guest appearance an episode of Dear to Glenn's Heart, in a certain way, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, a show which is like the 90s concentrated into a paste and then smeared on toast. So I submitted it to the canon. I'm not going to tell you how it turned out, but I will tell you I didn't really care how it turned out. I just wanted to spend 15 minutes describing an episode of Lois and Clark and playing clips, which is what I did, which is the most fun thing to do maybe in the world. And it was great fun. And we talked about American Crime Story, which is the O.J. Simpson thing coming out on FX. I talked about Rehab Addict. If you're a person who watches Rehab Addict, I talked about the Nicole Curtis and Rehab Addict and a bunch of other stuff. It's a terrifically fun show. I had a great time. It was the first time, I think, that the entire bullpen that I worked with in New York during the time that we all worked there together, Sarah and Tara and Dave and Joe and I, it was the first time we had all been together and done something together. So it was really pretty exciting and fun. So again, it's called Extra Hot Great. And you can find that as well as all their other cool stuff at previously.tv. So that is what's making me enormously happy this week. I was so excited to do it. So thanks to them for inviting me. And I hope that you will give it a listen, if only to find out what happened to Dean Cain. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In and Out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now and will be doing during several upcoming musical numbers. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.